Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with veteran Canadian jazz drummer and composer Mark Kelso. We covered his new 2022 CD, The Dragon's Tale, and A Great Life in Music. This new album is his third release by the premier jazz fusion quintet, The Jazz Exiles. Originally from Belfast, Northern Ireland, Toronto is now his home. His ability to play a wide variety of musical styles has helped him become one of Canada's most sought-after drummers. Along with the drums, he is also a singer, producer, and composer. Dig this interview.
Joe Domino.
What's up, man? How's life?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Hey, everything's good. The sun's shining here in Kansas City.
Oh, well, nice. Actually, it's pretty good here in Mississauga, Ontario, as well.
Okay.
I was just looking online here, and I see you've done a whole bunch of Toronto people here: Kirk McDonald, Sundar Viswanathan, Allison Au, and Nick McLean, and Ernesto Savini, Andy Mill, Richard Underhill. A whole bunch of my friends and buddies that I work with here. That's awesome.
And I have grown into a greater appreciation for the Canadian world than I ever thought I would in my life. The fact that the government supports so many arts grants, and you have healthcare that's socialized. I absolutely love what you guys are doing. I mean, you know, after the whole thing happened, when gun violence happens, countries respond to what America did, and you all responded in a much more loud, resounding way than Americans ever will with our government. So I think it's pretty progressive up there.
Yeah, you know, no place is without its issues, but I got to say, I do love living here, like 100%. We got a pretty good thing going here, you know, and I don't know if you know, but I was originally from Northern Ireland, so, you know, my family, when we moved here in the 70s, we left a lot of that gun violence back there, you know, and even there, they kind of straightened it out over the years, you know. Belfast is a great place to go to now.
Absolutely. So, well, are you a Blue Jays fan by any chance?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, yeah, I support all the local Toronto teams, but I'm not a big sports guy, to be honest. I was always sort of I love tennis, and I was always a big fan of a lot of the American tennis players, you know, Agassi, Sampras, back in those days in the 90s. I really was into playing a lot, but tennis and drumming is not a good combination after a certain point.
Yeah, you know? Well,
It's too much with the arms. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, we had a guy on the Royals, Whit Merrifield, and there was a famous story this summer where when the Royals went to Toronto, about 10 of the guys couldn't go because they didn't have their vaccines. Well, one of them, Whit Merrifield. Yeah. So one of our best guys, and he's been our consistently best guy, one of the top hitters in the league for the last 3 or 4 years, Whit Merrifield, he made a big deal that if the Royals would have been a contender, he would have gotten a shot. And when the trade deadline came around, they traded him up there and forced his hand. So they traded him to Toronto and got him out of Kansas City, kind of in magnanimous fashion. So that's another memory I have of the link between Toronto and Kansas City.
Right. And was he happy about that?
I think he got the shot that Blue Jays are a contender. And, yeah, I think he may have done it. But part of me, I've heard enough interviews with Whit. He's a pretty smart guy. I think part of him was playing a poker hand with ownership, saying, all right, let's see what you guys got. And they were like, all right, we got a full house. We'll see you later. And he's probably happy that he got out. We're a cellar-dwelling team. We've been for, like, since we won it in 15. So, yeah, so he was probably happy, I think. You know? And it's beautiful up there. Yeah, my son has special needs, and we got to meet one of the players, Nicky Lopez, and we're like, what cities do you like to go to? And he was like, man, we love the most beautiful cities on our schedule. And he said Toronto was like one of the top ones.
Oh, great. Awesome. Most Americans, when they come here, they're like, wow, your city's so clean.
Yeah. I hear that all the time.
It is? I mean, to us, we don't even notice it. I don't, you know, it's kind of funny.
It's probably going up to a hospital worker and saying, man, this place is really clean. And they're like, well, yeah, why wouldn't it be?
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Hey, I appreciate you taking a minute out to talk about the Dragon's Tale and your life and music. So thank you for taking a minute out for Neon Jazz. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So before we get into the Dragon's Tale, you know, the elephant in the room is the fact that we've gone through a pandemic on a global scale for the last couple of years. How did you survive through it, and how have you changed now that we're coming out of it?
Well, you know, when it was all going down, I mean, I was like everybody else thinking, oh, well, this will last a couple of weeks. And then as it continued on, it was like, oh, okay, this is going on. And it just kept going on. And then all the gigs stopped and everything dried up. And there was a point where I thought, is this it? Is it all over? You know, and I thought, it can't be, you know, because things like, you know, World War II was 5 years long and people came out of it and things changed. So I thought that we would come through it, you know, but for me, during that time when all the gigs dried up, I was really kind of struggling to go to find what can I do with my creativity. And I ended up starting to make drum videos. I got Final Cut Pro and, you know, I have a home studio, so I was recording my drums and I started messing around with my iPhone and taking some video and then adding it together. And before you know it, I'd put up a whole stack of videos online. And that became my go-to for creativity. I was still practicing, but I found it really difficult to be motivated because I wasn't playing. You know, when I'm practicing tunes or rhythm and gigs. So I always had the fine end result there to do something. And I found without those gigs that I was a little bit adrift in what am I doing this for? I just want to keep playing, but I was having a hard time with the motivation, and I think doing the videos really helped. Now, I was teaching. I just retired from teaching at Humber College. I was teaching in the music program there, so I did a lot of online teaching and just was working on organizing all the tech for that, and then I started making videos with my ensemble and then mixing it. So I still was able to do something musically. I just wasn't playing as much. And at the end of the last, I think about April this year, or last year, I think I wrote about eight of them, just came to me and blitzed it all out. And I was like, wow, I got a record. I tried to figure out, okay, how are we going to record this if we can't go into the studio, you know? But, I mean, long story short, we were all separated. We all worked it out. So I think, you know, to your second question, how did I come out of it? I would just say, like anybody else, I'm a survivor. And I didn't let it beat me down. I mean, there was no way I was going to give up playing music or playing drums. It's too important to me, and I've been doing it for such a long time that I wasn't going to let something like a pandemic shut that down. So I, even though I was in it, I wasn't really aware that I was putting my creativity into something else. But then now that we're back, I'm like, oh, man, look at all the stuff I learned. I learned more about arranging horns. I learned more about working Logic. I learned more about, using Final Cut Pro and editing video. And I read a ton of books, you know. So I just kind of, the thing for me was just trying to maintain that creativity and coming out and feeling like, yeah, I survived this long period where there was not, you know, any work, which is something that none of us anywhere have experienced in probably a very, very long time. So I just feel good that I came out of it on the flip side feeling that fine, that I survived it, and it didn't take me out. Like, I know a lot of musicians left town, a bunch of people just kind of packed it in. So, you know, when you're seeing those kind of stories, you go, ooh, man, that's rough. I'm seeing these things happen, you know, but I didn't want that to happen to me. So I just kept my perseverance up.
So how did a kid from Ireland get into jazz and get to Canada?
You know, my dad was a drummer. My dad was a drummer in an Irish show band. And the Irish show bands were the big craze in Ireland back in the 60s, you know, and he had traveled the world, you know, going to different countries. I remember one kind of really maybe traumatizing for my mother and my dad moment. When I was 8 years old, they came home, and we lived in a mixed area of Protestants and Catholics. Right, the Irish and the British, the whole thing. And, you know, everything was cool. But one time they came home and there was a military vehicle outside my a house after, you know, my dad was at work and my mom went out with him. So they're like, uh-oh, something's happened, something bad. So my mom's freaking out. They run into the house. There's a whole bunch of army officers in there. They see me and I'm there, but I happen to have a machine gun in my hand because the army officer, who turns out was the boyfriend of the babysitter, was showing me and teaching me how to put a machine gun together, like a real machine gun at 8 years old. So definitely different times in the 70s, you know, not too many rules. Obviously, that would never happen today, hopefully. But that, I think, was one of the final things. And it was like, yeah, we gotta get out of here. And my dad had, you know, at that time, they were taking immigrants to Canada, Australia, and South Africa. And I think he chose Canada because he'd been here, liked it. I think it was in the summer, though. And then he just said, okay, Canada's the closest. So if we go there and we don't like it, it's not as far to come back. That was the only reason we ended up here. And he came here, he loved it. And me and my sister, we, you know, just kind of took to the place. And, you know, I'm happy that we came to Canada. And as I said, he was a drummer and he was a big jazz fan. He loved guys like Buddy Rich, you know, and he had some Art Blakey records and Max Roach records. And, you know, when I was on the road with him in the States during my grade 6 year for about 6 months, because they were traveling with the band, and he took the family with him, and I got him to teach me drums in the nightclub. So we'd play during the day, and then I progressed quickly, and then I kind of got to a point where I hit a wall, and I freaked out and said, he tells me, I threw my sticks down and said, I'm done. And my dad's like, oh no, I've ruined it. I've pushed him too hard, too quick, you know? And then I think when we got back to Canada, when I got to grade 7, I was like, oh, I met some friends, and we started jamming again. And I started picking it up because I could sort of still play a bit. And that was it. I think I made that choice around 13 to play drums. And I was just influenced by his record collection. You know, he had the Buddy Rich stuff and Blakey and Max Roach, as I said. But he also had Tower Power. And so I got really into David Garibaldi. And then he had this guy, Canadian singer Gino Vannelli, and his drummer Graham Lear, who was kind of like my first experience with a guy who'd played jazz and rock. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, you can kind of do both, right? Because things were, I don't want to say sort of separate back then, but there was definitely a jazz crowd and a pop rock funk crowd, and you sort of didn't go between the two. But when I started getting into grade 11, and my teacher, Lou Bartolomucci, let me hear Steve Gadd with Chick Corea, I was kind of like, oh, wait a minute, this guy's playing everything, different styles with all these different people. I want to do that. And I just kind of kept my ears open to as many different styles as I could. So I think that's one of the main reasons I've had the career that I've had, is just the ability to jump into different musical settings. And I'm happy that I had kind of had that openness as a teenager, obviously influenced by great my dad and school teachers who, I guess, saw something in me that I was serious about playing music.
So you've been around a lot of heavy hitters. I mean, it starts from Pat Metheny, works its way all the way down a very long list of people, not only in jazz, but in pop and other realms. What have you learned from, like, the legends and luminaries that you've used to teach younger players you get around?
Oh, well, one of the first things, obviously, is your ability to listen. I think that your ability to listen, not only in musical circumstances, but also just in environmental circumstances when you're talking to people, how well you listen and interact and communicate is a big part of how you will play and approach music. If you've got poor listening skills, A, you won't be able to play things that you hear because you can't really comprehend them, but you also don't really respond well in music. If you're not listening, you're in big trouble. So the number one reason for success, I tell all my students, says you have to be a good listener. That's a priority at the top of the list before even technique or anything else. You've got to be a good listener. And then one of the other main points is you got to service the music, you know, and that's tough. That's a tough thing, I think, to tell people when you're young, because I definitely had, you know, I'd goof around on gigs maybe when I was 16, 17, just getting into the scene, because other people were goofing around and they wouldn't take certain kinds of music seriously. They would think it was beneath them. It's like, well, I'm not, you know, this is kind of just a wedding gig or something. And you see people fooling around. And then I remember seeing another drummer doing that when I was in the audience, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, is that what I look like? Man, that's bad. And I kind of made a conscious decision to not ever fool around on a gig ever again. because you know, A, you never know who's in the audience, and B, you never know why someone's not going to hire you again. So I kind of straightened myself out quickly, and then always tried to, what I tell the students, service the music. If the music requires you playing really simple, try and play that simple thing the best you can. And again, I would say I saw that from like guys like Carlos Vega, Steve Gadd, Steve Ferroni, you know, guys who could play just a great groove, and that would be enough. They didn't have to do any of the flashy stuff or any of the fancy chop stuff. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love soloing and playing and interactive music, but if the music doesn't call for it, you can't try and inflict your will on the music just because that's what you want to play. You have to be humble and kind of service the music, you know, and go, what's right for this song, and play what you think works for the music and for the other musicians playing. So I think those are kind of two of the big key elements for me that I like to pass on, because it's a different world today, you know, with social media. So many people are involved in how things look and see and how fast people go. And I, you know, I would try to get the kids to slow down and practice slow, you know, so various things, you know, like that.
Yeah. So everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, your fans, but ultimately you live your life. What's your perception of you? Who do you think you are?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure if I've ever been asked that. My perception of me, I'd like to think that I'm a professional. I'd like to think that I do a good job for every musical environment. I'd like to think that I'm a good husband, a good father. I think I have an outgoing personality. I try to be funny and always inject humor into things. I would say that I try not to take life too seriously, but I would always take music seriously. And I try to enjoy the moment, like live for the moment. I'm really into the kind of every day could be your last. You never know what's going to happen tomorrow. So try and do something every day. Work hard. I think I have a good work ethic. I don't know. I don't want to come off super egotistical. You know.
Yeah,
oh,
no.
I'm super really good looking and handsome.
There you go. You got to top that off with that. I love it, Mark. Thanks for opening up about the music. Thank you for talking to me about your life and music. Good luck with the album and the return to the stage. I appreciate it, man.
Man, Joe, thank you so much. I appreciate this very, very much.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in Toronto, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Mark for his time, energy, and cool. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com. And for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to the NeonJazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.